on the call new today? Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hello. This is Simon.
Hi, Simon.
I'm from Uport. This is my first time on this call.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. Let's see. Anyone else joining for the first time?
What's your last name, Simon? Describe, interrupt. Simon, what's your last name? Just for the minutes.
It's Caruzas.
Could you type that out in IRC, please? I'm going to have a hard time figuring it out. Thanks.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Kim, it's Gulpreet. I just wanted to introduce myself as well. I've kind of been lurking on the calls, but this time I thought I'll say hello.
Perfect. So, I was just going to call on you, actually. I thought I'd call you. Can you introduce yourself to the group?
Yeah, I've been working on Clue, and I was at the workshop in spring in Santa Barbara, and since then I've been kind of lurking on the calls. We are doing some DID integration in the Clue protocol, so that's one thing. And also, I am kind of starting work on a Go implementation of BTCR. So if anyone wants to help out, you know, or show, point me in the right directions or something, that would be fun. That's me.
Excellent. We have a BTCR hackathon coming up soon, so we'll make sure that you're looped into that.
Yeah, that's what triggered my interest in trying to do the Go implementation.
Excellent.
Do you mind typing your full name out in IRC just so that we get it for the minutes?
Done.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go over the agenda now. And I did things out of order, I guess. So, yeah, we already did introductions and reintroductions. Next, announcements and reminders. Then we'll move to progress on current action items, status of work items, some more focal use cases for the formation of the DID working group. And then lastly, we'll close with just a discussion of Marcus Abadello's DID authentication rebooting Web of Trust paper. Okay, so first let's do announcements and reminders. So first, we will have a summer BTCR outreach that will be July the 16th. I have an action item to send out a planning meeting for that, sort of talk about where everyone's at with their various implementations and plan what we might work on so we can try to loop in other people as well who want to contribute. Next, we have My Data in Helsinki. That's going to be August 29th through 31st. There will be no decentralized identifier panel, but there will be quite a few people from the credentials community group there giving talks on various aspects of DIDs. Next, rebooting Web of Trust 7, we think it will be week of September 24th in Toronto. I think we're still having issues getting a venue, but I think we'll get back to that shortly. TPAC is October 23rd through 26th in Lyon, France. There are some early bird discounts if you're interested in going to that. And Joe, I'll get to you right after this next one.
Sure.
Let me send the link to TPAC. And then lastly, IIW, the same time as TPAC, that's October 23rd through 25th. It's in Mountain View. And I'm going to call on Joe to talk about the rebooting status.
Yeah, let's bundle that in. I want to address this as a current action item, which technically is the next section, but we'll just go ahead and knock it out. So I want to say Danny Buchner just did report in that it looks like we have the space. He hopes to have final confirmation about what the actual details are today. So that's good news. I wanted to queue up a question for Manu about this 90-day advance window, and which I think we're upon. It is upon us. So unless I'm wrong, Manu, I think that means we won't be able to do the W3C workshop that week. Is that correct?
Yeah, and unfortunately, they have not let us know that they're probably going to move it to November. So there's a communication breakdown between W3C and us, unfortunately. So yeah, I'm pretty sure the W3C event's not going to happen, and that's going to change the way that we proposed the DID stuff at TPAC. I was hoping that we'd go in with a proposal that then we could say we're going to go vote on, but now it looks like we're going to go in with a proposal and tell everyone about it, and then there's going to be a separate workshop after TPAC in November where we discuss it, and then there will be the vote. So unfortunately, that means people have to fly to two different locations instead of all, you know, getting it all done that week.
Okay, so that's it for announcements. I'm going to move on to progress of current action items. First, we did some action item pruning last week, Joe and I. So we recently closed everything in this query. So we wanted to just point this out in case anyone has any objections. We tried to tag people who are affected by it. We have closed out the issue tracking opencreds.org updates, moves, and redirects. It looks like I think David Lane did all of the work there. Move verifiable news repo to rebooting Web of Trust. We decided to close that one out. We gave Sandro a heads up that, you know, the verifiable news repo is there if he wants to use it. And so he said, you know, great. So we're that was the exit criteria basically for that issue. So we're closing that out. Open this other open creds update plan number 9. That looks like a duplicate of the other open creds. Spec text version of registries process we closed out as well. There's basically something that is submitted. Yes, Manu submitted the PR for that. Lastly, my data panel at Helsinki, we decided that we are not doing that, but we are having other CCG members give talks. Let me check the queue. Christopher.
Yeah, I just had a question regarding the open cred thing. Were there any documents there that, you know, need to be that aren't just historical, but, you know, need to be brought forward as potential work items to continue to work on?
Manu?
Probably not. I'm checking right now, but I think we've basically moved everything over. Checking the specs now. So here's the page on everything that community worked on, that community being this community. So we have vision, glossary, use cases, roadmap, and then the identity credentials spec. Identity credentials has now become the VC data models thing. Use cases, you know, Joe and team have taken that over. Glossary has been moved into the VC data model. Vision is in the VC data model. We don't have a roadmap, but that's kind of the landing page on the CCG. So I think everything's moved over.
Thank you.
The second action items we're planning to discuss was the W3C 90-day advance window closing, but we already covered that. It sounds like it's going to be in November instead of along with rebooting.
So this is sort of my other thing in here. Financially, the Lyon one is expensive, and how important is it for us if there's going to be one in November? I'm just trying to prioritize.
Unfortunately, both of them are going to be pretty important because I think people are going to try to stop the work at both events. So, you know, if we don't show up to one of them, it's the one that we don't show up to where they decide that it's not important to move the work forward.
Okay.
That's typically how it works. I mean, if I'm going to be cynical, it's a large company strategy to make it difficult to participate in these things so that, you know, they can go to every single one and shut the work down at the event where they get to say the most. If I'm being, you know, positive about it, it's just, you know, we were just unable to agree on exactly what the W3C workshop was going to be about. And there's a chance that it's going to be about a broader topic than just DIDs. It's going to be about, like, authentication, authorization, DIDs, OpenID Connect, updating that stuff, FIDO, and that sort of thing. So, you know, if you can only come to one, I don't have a good recommendation other than potentially, you know, don't go to Lyon because no decision is going to be made there. And the workshop will be a more focused event. So probably go to the workshop instead of Lyon would be my suggestion.
Before I get to Ryan, Drummond, did you have any follow-up questions? So Drummond asked in IRC, what do you anticipate is going to be a problem?
I was just curious, you know, what – if Manu basically had new information about potential opposition, this is the first I've heard of the dedicated workshop, and I do know about the politics around those. So, Manu, did you have any updated, concerns?
A bit. I mean, the it's not really updated. It's the things that we thought were not, non-issues are becoming issues again. So the same questions are being raised again. Why aren't you using OpenID? Why are you not using, JWT? The problems that the DID working group is attempting to address are already solved through using FIDO keys and WebAuthn and OpenID. So what's the purpose for the group existing? It's the same. It's kind of the same old, same old. It's the same individuals re-raising those questions and kind of raising those concerns with W3C management, who are then saying, okay, well, if we propose a DID working group charter, we're going to get formal objections based on this stuff, so we need to thoroughly explore it in a workshop.
Yes, that's what I've seen before.
Yep.
All right, well, maybe we should strategize offline a little bit. That was all I wanted to ask right now.
Yeah, fundamentally, the thing that overcomes that is a large group of people showing up and saying, we want this thing to happen. And if we cannot get a large group of, and I mean, that's why we were trying to have a co-located event in Canada with rebooting, so that the rebooting folks could show up and say, we want this thing to happen. Now that the workshop's moved, we're going to lose a lot of participation because the expense of flying, you know, to who knows where in the world to have a two-day workshop where we only talk about a DID working group at W3C, many of the rebooting participants are just not going to be able to afford to do that. Right? It's a $2,000 ask.
Yep.
Hey, guys, I just jumped on. Can you please where is it moving?
We don't know yet.
Oh.
But it's basically, and again, this is just, you know, two pieces of information that it's moving to November. So it won't be in, but we have not received that information formally.
So Ryan, you're up.
I have again a question about travel. How can remote participants in the W3C express their support in a way that does not allow brigading to interrupt the work? Is it possible to incorporate online elements in such a workshop?
I could respond to that. If someone doesn't mind scribing, I'm missing a lot because I'm talking.
I got it.
Thanks, Kim. Ryan, I'm going to try to break down where you can, where people that are not W3C members can participate. So rebooting is open to anyone. Anyone can participate. And the same thing for, I expect that, the hackathon up in Canada. And so that's thanks to Dan and his work getting that venue set up. So anyone can participate in that, as far as I understand it. W3C TPAC is specifically for W3C members. So if you're not paying a membership fee, there are ways for you to get in there, like attend community group meetings and things of that nature, but those are fairly limited. Frankly, it's not really worth the expense of flying there, because you have no vote at W3C if you're not paying membership dues. There is remote participation, so that, you know, that's good. You can always show up, but it's literally you're going to be, you know, listening to audio and on an IRC channel, just like this. This is how you participate remotely. The W3C workshops, we try really hard to have remote access and be able to provide input. They tend to be open, but they tend to limit some of the attendees, meaning just, you know, for example, journalists are not usually welcome because then the larger companies don't like showing up and speaking their mind at the workshop. So, you know, certain people, certain types, classifications of people are not allowed to be in the workshop just because it kind of chills the discussion. And then on the vote, actually saying whether or not a DID working group could happen, should happen, you don't get to participate in the vote unless you're a paying W3C member. So that's why it's so important for us to whip up support with paying W3C members throughout this entire process, because they are ultimately the ones that are going to be saying whether or not W3C's resources should be spent on a working group. Did that answer your question, Ryan?
Almost. Does a paying W3C member have to attend to vote?
No, they can do so remotely.
So it's really a question about drumming up support before the vote.
Yes, but the vote doesn't happen if W3C management is convinced that it doesn't need to happen. So the votes can be killed before they happen. It's rarely, if ever, does that happen. But, you know, one of the outcomes, just to remind everyone, it is up to W3C management exactly what form a working group takes, which staff members assign to it, and things of that nature. It's their judgment call. So if they see something happen at a workshop where it's clear to them that it's going to be difficult to do a working group, they may delay the vote for many months while those issues are worked through.
And is that a political process, or do they need to be able to explain their reason for not doing a vote?
It's a political process. All of its standards are politics, largely. There's, you know, 30% technical, 70% politics. Any decision needs to have a rationale behind it. The membership demands that. Things can be put off such that a decision isn't made for a very long time. So that's typically how this kind of work is stalled. So, for example, the verifiable credential stuff was stalled for about 6 to 8 months because decisions were being put off while they attempted to address formal objections behind the scenes.
Okay. Let's move on to, we're still on progress of current action items. The next one is hackathon date TBD. So this is the one that is in theory, I believe, after rebooting September 22nd through 26th. Is there anything anyone wanted to comment on that hackathon?
Just to correct the date, it looks like it would be the 27th and 28th of September. Right, so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, rebooting Web of Trust, 24th, 25th, and 26th. And then that Thursday, Friday, the hackathon. And I want to reach out. I think we had at least one person from UPort on the call. I'd love to talk to you guys about how to get you more engaged. Drummond, also, I just sent you an email to see what we can do to support Sovereign's DID method there. So just a shout out to folks working on deployed DID methods. We'd love to support them at this hackathon.
Next, we have a sort of more of a ping on this JWK crypto suite specifications issue that I linked to here, issue number 18. I think we have that informally assigned to UPort. And we weren't able to assign it to Christian specifically. I think he wasn't a member of the repo. So if anyone on the call is from UPort and, you know, has an update on that, let us know. Otherwise, the chairs will be following up by email. Other items, actually, we spent a lot of time on action items, so I'm going to move on to work items. Does anyone have any status they want to report? Please add yourself to the queue if so. Okay, excellent. I'm going to move on to the next. We still have a lot of content to get through. Next, let's talk about focal use cases for the formation of the DID working group. I'm including this document that Joe has arranged. And we're going to start with Adrian and his use case, which should be number 12 on this, in this document, about prescriptions. So Adrian, do you want to take it over?
Sure. I don't know if I think people can read silently to themselves. It's fairly short. So I'll just basically outline the use case is a patient accessing a physician online, a licensed practitioner online, and then getting a prescription that she takes to a pharmacy in person, and it's filled. And the prescription is the verifiable credential. And the identities of the three people are the DIDs of the individuals involved. Some of them may or may not have DIDs. Now, so the particular questions that I'd like to talk about with the group that are represented in this use case, which I don't think we have in any of the other use cases to the same extent, is we need to have a use case that has specific regulations we can point to in some country. It doesn't have to be the U.S., but obviously many of us are familiar with, you know, health-related and prescription-related regulations here. We need to have a security analysis so that we could defend what we're doing, you know, as this stuff moves forward. And we need to consciously have an example of privacy engineering. In other words, in the other use cases, that at least the ones that I've heard that I've paid attention to, I'm not saying they're all like this, there's a lot of hypotheticals. In other words, we want to protect privacy in against collusion and against tracking and stuff like that. And what I'm trying to do with this particular use case is to pick one example of how we engineer for one aspect of privacy. In this particular case, again, you know, in other words, to do the privacy engineering thing specifically in one case, and then maybe that way some of the other use cases can follow the same pattern and do the privacy engineering in them. So anyway, those are my three questions for discussion, and if any, and not, we can move on, or I can answer questions if I'm not being clear about what the use case itself is.
Thanks, Adrian. We have Joe next on the queue.
Yeah, so Adrian, this is a great use case. I agree, we want at least one that talks about the regulations. There's a threat model approach we're using in the VCWG, for which might be a good place for both security analysis and some of the privacy engineering in terms of how we might flesh this out structurally. What's the process to elucidate that? One question I had about this for you, Adrian, is if Alice is never, if her identity is never assured, right, she's pseudonymous, is that compliant with regulations today?
It depends on the prescription. If it's not a controlled substance, the answer is yes. I mean, you know, you can the prescriptions can be for various reasons, and you know, in general, it's up to her relationship with the doctor primarily. So, for example, the doctor can stock medications in their cabinet and dispense them to Alice, keeping only the record in the doctor's office, and nobody needs to know. So there are lots of examples of this, and that's why I think this is a good case for privacy engineering as well as security analysis, because we have to pay attention to licensed professionals in the DID universe, because otherwise we're not really doing much different than federated identity or institutionally based identity that already is part of OpenID Foundation and the rest of the stuff. What makes DID unique, totally unique in my opinion, is the fact that it can be decentralized and fits with the verifiable credentials decentralization so well. And so that's what this use case tries to get at. It's this Venn diagram of licensed professionals as peers and the trust that we have in lawyers, accountants, doctors, and other licensed professionals.
Excellent. Thank you.
I think David Challoner is next on the queue.
Yeah, I had a question about this. It seems to me today when we have prescriptions, the pharmacist needs to know all the prescriptions I'm taking because they have to make sure there aren't any drug interactions. And my insurance company needs to know everything as well because they want to make sure that they're paying for them correctly and they're not going to object to the payment, and typically they have to decide how much they're going to pay for various prescriptions. And also they may want to suggest you go to a different pharmacy to reduce the cost. At least all that has happened to me in the last 60 days. So I don't really understand why we want anonymity in here when we, by almost definition, can't have an anonymity against our pharmacists, our insurance company, and our doctors.
Well, let me put it this way. We've spent in this group, I would say maybe a quarter or half the time worrying about privacy-related issues like tracking and correlation. There are hundreds of use cases or ways that we could complicate this particular use case along the lines that you mentioned. The reason to do privacy engineering, and I think to some extent the reason that we would want to formally adopt some privacy engineering principles, is to have a hierarchy of the kind of restrictions or whatever uses that you mentioned. Because what I'm saying is privacy engineering means that you start with a foundation that is as privacy preserving as you can manage. In other words, it's data minimization, if you want to think of it that way, or regulatory minimization, if you want to think of it in terms of regulations. And then you build through what the privacy engineering means is that as you have a reason, for example, to have somebody, whether it's the pharmacist or your doctor or somebody else, monitor all of your prescriptions, that's a different use case. If you have reason to think that the doctor is misbehaving and you want to have a prescription drug monitoring program, payment is yet another use case. So there are lots of things that we could privacy engineer in a hierarchy. What this particular use case is about is what is the bottom of that hierarchy. In other words, what is a reasonable set of regulations and security issues that already exist that we could have as a baseline, and then the things you say, which are all very important, are add-ons that build on top of the infrastructure and the standards that we put in as a baseline.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is what the problem you're trying to solve is, rather than something that's kind of abstract. I know today
it's not abstract at all. No, what I'm saying is,
sorry, can I jump in? I can't quite figure out how to use
please.
Q. I can speak to this personally. Planned Parenthood is for a lot of young people that can't regularly access doctors. A lot of them it's because of shame or they have to go without their parents. This is an example in a use case where a young woman could very easily this is a non-controlled substance. She just needs to be able to connect with the doctor to get a very simple script. We have doctors that are giving out weed prescriptions online. So I'm sure that the security and the privacy, that's a lot of nuance that we don't. I think this is a great use case. And I think that there's also something there to be said for at-risk youth. Would be more like, you know, maybe they have a school person or somebody that can verify they are who they are, that's like a trusted third party that's not their parents, that could then give them access to some sort of easy lower hierarchy is for like non-controlled substance prescriptions online.
Right.
Thanks.
And there's also birth control and legal, et cetera. So, I mean.
Right. This is my goal with this use case, is to find the lowest common denominator that has this element of a certified responsible individual rather than an institution, and that preserves privacy in a situation where, like psychiatric or reproductive health or whatever, where people understand it, so that we don't have to defend, you know, the mental health or the adolescent issues or whatever, and yet. So what I'm trying to do is to simplify this use case as much as possible while bringing in this relationship between the licensed professionals and the individual.
So I still don't really quite understand. The doctor is not going to prescribe something to somebody unless he can associate it, you know, with somebody that actually needs the prescription, because he doesn't want to give you a prescription, which you then give to somebody else. That's illegal.
It is not illegal. Look, I'm a physician. I do this. I'm trained to do this. This is not the issue here. Everything I'm trying to do with this example is to make sure that what we're doing is within the laws. And that's why I pointed to this particular law in this particular state, in the state of Washington, and this particular use case. This is not hypothetical. We have to
I need to jump in.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I have to jump in. So we need to freeze the queue on this topic. We have Joe Andrew next.
I just want to note one of the drivers for this, David, is to challenge some of those assumptions that you had taken as given. There's often data that is sold by the pharmacies or data aggregated by insurance companies that's a violation of privacy, simply because that was the easiest way for them to address their business case. And so we want to challenge that in part and see, to the extent it's legal, how can we re-architect so that we don't have those baked-in privacy problems?
So, Adrian,
I'm not
sure.
That's the best answer I've
heard. Yay!
Adrian, I don't think we got to all of your questions, but I think we'll wrap up here, and then we can move discussion to the mailing list, and we'll move on to Samantha's use cases.
But,
sorry?
Just one quick comment, please. Where in our process are we going to first have a security analysis for at least one of the use cases, if not this one, one of the other ones?
So that's a good question. So the way I think I want to do that is through the threat model approach we're using in the VCWG. So that'll follow on after. So right now we've asked for a bunch of use cases, and we're giving people an opportunity to present them and get feedback and engagement so that we as a community hear why different people are chasing this technology, contributing to the group. Once we get through that, we will need to pick a handful of focal use cases. And in that process, we will refine them and add some sections, in particular, at least a threat model, which I think is the right place to talk about both privacy and security.
Thank you.
All right. Hey. Can whoever just asked about security also talk to me afterwards, because I don't know how to write about it, but I have another use case that's sort of around authenticating people on a Wi-Fi network to as like a sign-in, sign-out for contractors in smart homes, and I don't know how to describe some of the things I'm trying to describe, so if you could reach out to me after, I'd appreciate that. And my use case is personal because it's kind of like about me. I really grew up with the internet, and like because of that, I had platforms disappear on me. I grew my audience DJing and touring like by meeting people online and reaching out to them through MySpace and connecting through artists there. And by having my own night in Vancouver, I could host people, and they'd host me, and I built my audience quite naturally. And then when algorithmic feeds were introduced to SoundCloud, I really rapidly noticed the whole industry change. There was all of a sudden all these different sort of like to downloads and these sort of third-party models, and I think that's sort of what leads to a lot of the downfall of any great platform is when third-party sort of workarounds and sort of automation and bots kind of take over. Anyways, what's frustrating is that because there's so many different platforms now, a lot of awards people and agents, they look at your numbers. But in something like the last 4 years, like SoundCloud's kind of become garbage, and Spotify is where it's at. But Spotify was before just very like an elitist kind of album label thing. So there was a lot of catching up, and it really hurt a lot of people. And for me, I just was frustrated with the whole situation and didn't want to be touring anyway. So I just focused on producing. But it affects a tremendous amount of people, and there's no real way other than what I see now, which is Google says you can claim your ID if it's Googled enough, or you can submit that. But it doesn't help anyone to convey the information they want to convey, because I don't know how people are finding me, and I don't even know how I show up in their search results, because everybody's search results are different. I've literally had the wrong face on a poster before, and my friend's had it happen like 3 times to her, where people just use the search results from Google, but it's like a lot of the images aren't even her. So you know, services offer this blue check, but they don't offer what I'm wondering is there a way that we can just like connect all the streaming data from these APIs to a single counter that's attached to an ID that I've authed through what I choose to log in and auth to it, like my Facebook, my whatever. And then all of that count can be there. But I'm also wondering if it's possible for there to sort of hold for that to hold just a directory that points to archive.org blog posts and things like that, because that's another thing. Like, I've been an artist for like 20 years, and I've gone through this whole cycle of the internet where like lots of stuff that I have screenshotted just doesn't exist on the web anymore. If archival of self and archival of art, specifically music, because we're in such a horrific gate-kept era, this will be such, so much of our music will be lost. It already has been. Like, I've lost tons of mine. It's, I think, really important for people to be able to at least start to, like, think about how they can practice their own acts of archival and their own presentation of self and metrics as attached to some sort of, like, I see this maybe moving into how you could start to have your own personal, it just seems like a good signature, a good proof of self. It's like if you've connected all of your accounts and those are your metrics and your archive, then you can be more verified of self. I'm wondering if people can help me to understand how I could make this possible. I put up an example of my bot. It's pretty, just plays my SoundCloud right now. It's very crude, but I've been working on conversation architectures that I've trained through all everything I've ever written. So just trying to explore archival of self, but also a way to sort of have this verified entertainer's press kit.
Thank you so much, Samantha. We have a lot of plus ones in IRC, and Adrian, you're up on the queue.
Oh, I just wanted to comment to Heather's issue. In general, my approach has been to look in terms of agency. So you can't do much about how people archive information about you, how institutions, other than to have your own technology, your own agent that can keep track of those things and combine them and recombine them in ways that you control. So I think this the perspective of agency, of individual agency through self-sovereign technology is what is under, is not typically considered in solving the problem that that Heather's talking about.
So I'm going to interject real quickly. I did a time check and noticed we don't really have much time to get into DID auth, I think, is what I'll chop off so we can spend the rest of the time on Samantha's use cases. Let's see. If there's any objections to that, let me know. We have an active queue. So, Bowden, you're next.
Yes, hi. I think Samantha's use case is, in general way, it's how to prove ownership of a digital asset. And this use case is handled on a valid book by a statement of ownership. So in my opinion, in the future, everyone is going to have a base identity, and then they can link to that identity any digital asset. So any social networking account, any SoundCloud account, and well, any other digital asset that just needs a way to prove that they own this. So in such way, anyone can gather any kind of digital assets to one base digital identity.
Heather, you're next.
Hey, thanks, Kim. Are you guys able to hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. So what's interesting is the context of the use case that Samantha outlined is one in which content is created on platforms that were created by corporations or organizations, or maybe started out as indie and then were acquired, like, for example, Blogger. I see this like split in a couple of different ways. One, so that is like the specific context like I think that Samantha's looking at. And I have direct experiences with that too, being an OG blogger, blogging on a lot of platforms, the stuff just disappearing one day when they decided to cut their advertising-based revenue model. So there's this idea of like reclaiming the content that you've created on these, for lack of a better word, corporate platforms. But there's also like been this totally different methodology that other people have used where, you know, those of us, we foresaw this and we didn't want to always play that game, is that we created our own brands, identities anchored to a domain or other things that we had a bit more control over. Now, you know, with DNS and everything, you still don't own it forever, but you have a bit more control over it, and then aggregate these things off of a domain or some other thing that you have more control over. So when you're talking about, and in those situations, those domains can be fluid, moved, sold, removed, etc. And there may be reasons why you don't want content from a previous, you know, like your blog when you were like 30, partying in Los Angeles. Maybe you don't want all that to be when you're professional on the W3C call, right? So there's two inputs, right? The input is content that you created yourself on your own, you know, domain kind of, and like indie web, and I think some of the work Johannes Ernst has done has been around that space and reclaiming and kind of like a throwback to that attitude. But then you also have like digital natives that have grown up with, you know, just using the platforms that were given to them without totally understanding the implications that they don't own their content. So it's almost like a reclaiming of content that we've created on these platforms, which I think is really interesting. So I don't know if these are two different use cases or slightly different or what. There also needs to be for multiple media, right? Like I think Samantha's coming from more of a an audio, you know, music, those types of contexts.
I
come from more writing.
I think like
I come from more writing. And I think.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know how to. Go ahead.
I think that we can just like these are just different mediums that can be addressed within the same use case.
Sam, do you want to respond to that?
Sorry, no, I was just going to say, yeah, this you totally hit the heart of the issue, and thank you for so putting it all out so eloquently. I was just thinking, my question is, can we not just have even just the reclamation, like reclaiming our view count? Like, perhaps not just the content, maybe the content's gone, but if there was the metrics of your views as validation of your reach on that platform, even if it no longer exists, like maybe the file management and your content management and backing that up is still your responsibility for now, but at least that there could be some sort of just from the streaming data that's counted continuously if you start collecting it in a way, like if you can catch it.
So I think this is really, really cool. And to me, the first thing that comes to my mind with this is the reputation associated with the content that you created and the metrics of either your own personal reputation. I mean, you're talking about like aggregated reputation that comes from different streams, right? So that would be like, to me, in my mind, another layer on top of the content. Because like say you did all this stuff on MySpace, and you were super popular on there, and then everyone moved to another platform and had to start at zero. You know, there's an archetype here. It's called the success to the successful archetype, which is when you get into the top 10, you're going to stay in the top 10 just for the mere fact of being in the top 10. So I think that's an interesting thing and could be applied to all this content. And there's good reasons for that. But then there's also good reasons to do a reset and let new content and new information come in. So I think this could be a really robust and vibrant conversation to really tease out what would be important. And Kim, if no one has volunteered to scribe, I'm happy to take over.
Thank you very much. No one has, so thank you. And Sam, I'm actually going to ask your opinion what to do next. So we have three people on the queue, we can either, which I'm assuming are responding to your use case 13, we can either get through that and close it out or move on to your other use cases. What do you prefer? We have like 4 minutes left.
Oh, I'd love to keep hearing everybody else's response.
Okay, excellent. So we will move the others to a subsequent week. Christopher, you're next.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm obviously hearing some of the indie web. You know, a lot of us, you know, owned our own domains, you know, early on, rather than using Gogger or Typepad or any of the free domain type things a long ways back. But I'm actually hearing something a little bit different than that. I'm hearing the sort of free association type of thing. What it feels like is that, Sam has created fans. She's created associations with people where she does not own those associations, nor do the fans. They're owned by Spotify. They're owned by Blogger. They're owned by whoever. And then when she moves her content, her new information, et cetera, to a new place, those associations, those connections, which include things like, I listened to her, to her song 1,000 times over the last 2 years, are lost. So for me, I actually see that, the new thing that is possible, we can kind of replicate the indie web and be even better than DNS, but the new thing is that the associations, the edges can be portable as well. So when someone who's created like I have 10,000 followers on Twitter, I can't take them to Mastodon. It's not my content on Twitter that's really valuable. It's the 10,000 connections to people who want to listen to me that's valuable, and that's not portable. And that's maybe the aspect or the user story hearing in here that is new, because it's about two or more people that want to associate and want those associations to have some persistence, as well as, privacy for those people, there can still be privacy here, because these are voluntary associations. I don't have to voluntarily associate with Ivanka Trump if she wants to follow me. That's it.
Would this be like a decentralized RSS feed kind of thing? Like you could subscribe to my feed, which is also my counter, which is also my without having a website.
Yeah, adding in the element of that it's a two-way. It's a not only is it a verifiable claim, this is me, it's also a verifiable claim that I am following you.
You're right. Yeah.
Which is, yeah. Whereas the RSS you don't know who's reading it. Okay, that's it for me.
Heather, you're next. Heather, are you on mute?
Oh, hey, that was old, but I do have a quick comment. That super reminded me of when I worked at AOL. I was the product manager for identity. And I actually ran the account linking project there. And one of the big questions was interoperability between instant messaging systems, which was technically possible, but people refused to do it. And we actually had technology where we developed, like, you could port into and out of exactly what you're talking about with, like, instant messenger followers. It's probably technically possible from a business model standpoint. The companies and the businesses are going to, like, fight you tooth and nail. So
we're going to close the meeting with Bowden.
Okay. I have two comments. Here, one comment is on the question about having archive. The question is, there is a SoundCloud account, then SoundCloud is no more relevant. I have to move to Spotify and prove that I was very popular on SoundCloud. There is a practical way to solve it, not complete, but in practice somewhat solvable. You can make a snapshot of your SoundCloud account. Just download the page with all data in there, and you can have it, and you can sign it with your identity, and then you have a proof that you were really popular on SoundCloud. Another question that Christopher has touched about moving your followers from one service to another service. So you want to indicate that now you or some other service. I just have a comment to that if you would have a base identity to which you link all your other digital assets, you would be able to do that in a way. You anyway can do this, right? You just post on Spotify that now it's my account, or you post on SoundCloud, please go to Spotify, there is a new account of me. But also you will be do it through through your base digital account, digital identity. Okay, that's all for me.
Right now they claim they own your fans, they own the website, copying a SoundCloud website, even though it's got some of your content in it, is copyrighted by somebody else as an aggregate, and they claim ownership of the aggregate.
Yeah, so
it's weird.
I think
it's true.
I think if we have base digital identity, then we can push to the services that there needs to be a translation from one followers, how they know, how people are known on their service, to their digital, to their base digital identity, and then it will be easier to let's say you have followers on SoundCloud, then they SoundCloud has to allow you to send messages to all of your followers there that will have a link to new to your new service. And there just needs to be interoperability between one service and another service. So basically, your followers on SoundCloud will have to click on a button and they become your followers on Spotify. So if you can push for such functionality, and if you have a base digital identity with some standard to allow to do this, I think it's possible.
So we are past time, and I wanted to thank everyone for their input and Samantha for these use cases, and which we'll get to the next two in a following week. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.